I'm Raymond Arroyo. Dissent reached a head in 1968 with the release of the encyclical Humanae Vitae. The historic teaching of Paul VI reaffirmed the Church's opposition to artificial contraception and unleashed a torrent of scorn from some theologians. On this final installment of What Went Wrong with Vatican II, Dr. Ralph McInerney explores the continuing pattern of dissent. He'll explain how this mindset has created a warped understanding of the Second Vatican Council's teachings. He'll also examine the Pope's recent efforts to clarify Vatican II and to ensure its proper implementation into the next millennium.
Given the fact that theologians responded as negatively as they did to Humanae Vitae, this has built up a kind of habit now on their part, on the part of many of them, to respond negatively to anything that the Holy Father or generally the Vatican has to say, so that you can count on a negative response whenever a magisterial doctrine comes along. I say as a group because you can't separate the Catholic Theological Society of America from this sort of reaction, because they've been more or less taken over by such dissenters and their committees and their meetings and so forth have tended to exhibit this sort of negative attitude towards the magisterium, and to think of themselves as in some way a rival magisterium, as if one could choose either to follow the Pope and bishops on the one hand or the theologians on the other. This is an unprecedented suggestion and very disruptive in the Church.
And what do they use of the Vatican II documents to justify their position?
They didn't. Actually, in 1968, Karl Rahner, the German Jesuit theologian, began to talk about a second magisterium of the theologians. And he thought there was such a one because of the reaction to Humanae Vitae. And he effectively asked, well, what's going on here when you have all of these learned theologians saying that they disagree with the papal document? And he suggested that here you have a magisterium, a second magisterium of the theologians, and the primary or first magisterium of the Pope and the bishops. Well, of course, the question that arises then is, and this is the impossible position that this puts ordinary Catholics in, how do you adjudicate a dispute between, on the one hand, the papal magisterium, and on the other, the theologians? Do you have to be a theologian to adjudicate the dispute, or a pope to adjudicate the dispute, or do you just flip a coin? There's something terribly cynical about putting ordinary Catholics in that kind of a position and saying, you choose between these two authorities, particularly when one of the bits of advice is, in effect, telling people to take the easy way, or what seemed to be the easy way. It doesn't look like a very even proposition. But that's, at any rate, the position that they put Catholics in. When Father Rahner put that question to himself, well, who will decide? He said, history will decide. Well, people who are going off on their honeymoon don't have time to wait for the verdict of history, let's say. So this, again, is cynical, and it just seems to me to betray a kind of divorce from the pastoral and evangelizing role of theologians from this kind of airy speculation as to what people might do. Mm-hmm. At any rate, you got this sort of justification, and then one would quote the other until after a while theologians say, and it became a kind of received opinion, but there's no basis for it.
And eventually the teachings of the council began to be distorted in this fashion.
What you then had was this: the Pope, who was behind Humanae Vitae, when he would talk about the council, of course he was wrong on the council too. So the thing just sort of mushroomed all over the place. That's why the Second Extraordinary Synod was so important, because here you had the Synod, like the Ecumenical Council, is made up of bishops, not all the bishops, but representatives from all over the world. And they acknowledged that you had this distortion going on. And many of us had thought we noticed that, but here was an official kind of recognition of it.
Has the Church become a harbinger of this sort of dissent and an incubator of it in the university setting?
The universities are implicated in this from the very beginning. Someone has argued that all of this stuff really started on seminary faculties. Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that in 1968 it was university professors of theology who were deeply involved in this kind of dissent. And one of the reasons, again, exculpating reasons, is that during the intervening years as teachers, they were teaching, in many cases, that this is about to happen. And their professional reputation, you might say, was in some way bound up with it. So it made them feel, I suppose, a little foolish. But at any rate, not psychoanalyzing them, that's unfair. But at any rate, they rejected this document. Now, university professors are teaching students, graduate students, who are going to go on and do what their teachers do. Maybe not at the university level, but say at the college level. Or maybe they're going to teach in high school. So that this kind of thing going on in universities created a trickle-down effect through the church, through the various educational layers or levels, so to say, and then finally into the more directly pastoral work in the parishes and so forth. So that as the universities went eventually, so the parishes went. So it was a serious kind of seedbed, the university, for dissent in church generally.
Why has the Holy Office, in your opinion, been so slow to correct the distortions of Vatican II and to correct these dissenters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one often wonders what takes so long. I mean, the church is notably slow, certainly in recent centuries, to jump on people and to close off discussion. There's a long patience. And that's not to be derided, it seems to me. They want to make sure that they've got it right. You really are saying such and such. Is that the case? So there has been in post-conciliar times, long exchanges between theologians and the Vatican. They've gone over and they've talked and so forth. Hans Kuhn is a good example. He went back and forth when allegedly whenever he would go over to talk about one book, he said, "I'll write another book and clarify that." The next book would cause a similar trouble. Back he would go. Eventually, it was acknowledged he was declared no longer to be a Catholic theologian, and it was overdue in many people's estimation, including Karl Rahner, who said that he found it easier to talk with Hans Kuhn, imagining that he was talking with a Protestant theologian than with another Catholic theologian. Many people had that experience or feeling, I think, with him and with many others, with a similar long patience. If there were not the practical impact on the church as a whole, one could only say, take all the time you need. I mean, what difference does it make, except the soul of this particular theologian? But when this sort of thing is not confined to the seminar rooms and so forth of universities, when it is being disseminated in various ways throughout the church, then that long patience begins to look a little less pleasant, and you just wonder, you know, whether it's wise. It's prudential, obviously. And
now, I know what you said, what your opinion of what went wrong with Vatican II is. What does Cardinal Ratzinger think went wrong with Vatican II?
Cardinal Ratzinger in the Ratzinger Report probably wouldn't have said in kind of stark terms that something had gone wrong with Vatican II, but he would say in the wake of Vatican II, certain people had said certain things about the Council. Of course, that's what one would want to mean anyway by the statement that Vatican II had gone wrong. And he enumerated a number of things. He enumerated theological teaching on sexual morality, the liturgy, a number of other things which he thought were biblical criticism, where he thought people had said things and done things that were very questionable and had invoked wrongly the authority of the council to justify what they were doing and teaching.
He also makes reference to an anti-spirit of Vatican II. What is the anti-spirit of Vatican II?
Well, he's almost quoting someone else, von Balthasar, I think it was, who first used that kind of language, there is, in many respects, as an historical thing, there is an anti-papal or an anti-Roman mood in France that goes back, has long historical roots, not all of them totally ignoble, but sometimes it goes back almost to the Great Schism in the case of France, in the Avignon papacy and alike. But there are, put it this way, sometimes there are objections to Rome or the Vatican, which are objections to bureaucracies and dealing with a functionary in this office and so forth. And these are to be treated, I think, very differently from confrontational remarks about the contents of a papal encyclical and so forth. That's a quite different thing. So I don't know how I get onto this, but sometimes there are attitudes towards Rome, let's say, that are negative, and they're not sent. They're kind of quibbles or quarrels about a different style of management, let's say, or bureaucracy and the like, and one can be sympathetic for that. The anti-spirit is, I think, partly this kind of papal spirit. It seems to me that's what it's come down to increasingly, because there's been this effort to try to, and it's, again, this too has historical roots, to have conciliarism and then papalism, so that you try to play the council off against the Pope. And this is not unknown, where people will invoke the council against the Pope. He doesn't understand the council. They seldom quote chapter and verse when they do this sort of thing, I'm interested to notice. But it's gutsy, it seems to me, to suggest that that the man who is so heavily defined as the chief authority figure in the church by Vatican II somehow doesn't understand Vatican II very well.
How has the Vatican attempted to reclaim the teachings of the Second Vatican Council?
There has been, I think, an unrelenting and noble effort on the part of Paul VI and John Paul II to implement the Vatican Council. And this is some, by and large, I think their efforts have gone unheeded. By and large, their efforts have gone unheeded. Up until the present time, there's been a kind of escalation of it, you might say. In 1985, again, at that extraordinary synod I keep referring to, one of the suggestions that was made by Cardinal Law, as it happens, was that we ought to have a catechism, a new catechism based on Vatican II. And everybody thought that was a great idea. Well, that catechism has been produced, the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It's available now in English. There was a great struggle, incidentally, and it was a struggle that was won largely because of the efforts of Father Fessio and Monsignor Wren and others and the Fellowship of Catholic Scholars, who pointed out that it wasn't a matter of just preferences in English style. It had to do with doctrine as to what the catechism was being made to say as opposed to how it said it. As I say, this prevailed. So we do have now an English translation of the catechism, have had now for some years. Every Catholic ought to have that. When that came out, there was a lot of dismissal of that. That's not for Catholics, that's for somebody else. There is this almost a tireless effort to try to thwart the effort of the magisterium to bring to the people Vatican II in its purity. But the effort is made, it has been made, it goes on being made. Everything is in place. Everything is in place, it seems to me. There have been, obviously, implementations of the Council, but one has the sense that now we can begin. Now we're at a point where we could really begin the renewal that John the 23rd had in mind, address the modern world, make this message more effective in contemporary times.
What did that extraordinary Council, the second one that you mentioned in 1985, what did it accomplish?
Well, like all extraordinary synods, it produced a document, both of the fathers, synodal fathers, and one by the Holy Father himself. Very often, he's followed such synods with document. These, incidentally, are one of the fruits of Vatican II, to have synods and extraordinary synods and so on. So there is a constant consultation with the bishops of the world that goes into the magisterial documents. They're not just, you know, the Pope in his study, you know, dyspeptic or something, coming up with some strange document. I mean, they come out of the church. Not that he's polling or looking for some kind of consensus in a political sense, but he's very conscious of the fact that he's teaching with the other bishops. He's the primus inter pares. Their teaching authority is tied to his in a way that his isn't tied to theirs, but nonetheless, the episcopacy is a brotherhood of bishops. But what the Extraordinary Synod came up with then would be documents of the proceedings of the thing, certain resolutions that they had made, a final statement, final report, very brief, and then the Holy Fathers as well. But again, they're very practical documents. They're not, it wasn't largely doctrinal. It's what do we do? So that they're laying out what ought to be done, and one keeps waiting for it to be done.
What did they call for specifically? I know the profession of faith and the oath of fidelity.
In July of 1998, an apostolic letter was released called Ad Tuendam Fidem, to preserve the faith. And it had to do with the requirement, which was not new, that theologians, when they take on their task, that they, like bishops when they become bishops, would make a profession of faith and take an oath of fidelity. Now, the profession of faith consists in the recitation of the Nicene Creed. And certainly that ought not to be problematical. And the oath of faith comes down essentially to this: I believe what the Catholic Church teaches. Now, just as it's reasonable to expect that someone who becomes a bishop in the church would recite the Nicene Creed and then acknowledge that he believes what the church teaches, so too it's perfectly reasonable to expect that someone who is going to teach Catholic doctrine, Catholic theology, would recite the creed and acknowledge that he accepts what the Catholic Church teaches. In 1989, when this came up earlier, the Catholic Theological Society of America appointed a commission to study it. They saw this as a problem. They were alarmed, and all of their members were, as they described them, just very upset by this. And they produced a document which I think in the annals of insolence will live forever. It's one of the most impudent documents I've ever read in my life. But in effect, they decided that the requirement, which is a canon law requirement, that those who teach Catholic theology do the two things, make a profession of faith and an oath of fidelity, that this didn't apply to them. This didn't apply. A very cynical document. But it was a way of dismissing it. Under a ton of verbiage. Now, why did they dismiss it? Because in saying, I accept what the Catholic Church teaches, they would be understood to accept humani vitae. They would be understood to accept the teaching of the Church on contraception. And, of course, they're still stuck in the mud on that one. So that's the essence of the document. I'm interpreting it, but that seems to me to be the real nub of the document. Say, what's bugging these people? That's what's bugging them. So they're still back there in 1968. Now, why do I say back there? Because the great irony is that anyone who thinks that artificial contraception poses a problem for Roman Catholics or anyone else is nuts. I mean, it's simply obsolete as an issue. With natural family planning, there is just no problem involved here in terms of people responsibly and morally having a number of children that they think they can handle. So this it's a phony issue all the way through. Now, why will people who rejected humani vitae don't want to talk about natural family planning either? The thing is, you begin to see a kind of pattern here after a while. But at any rate, that was the case in 1989. Now, in 1998, out comes Ad Tuendam Fidem, and there is a reiteration of the requirement in order to preserve the faith, ad tuendam fidam, particularly with theologians. This is the Holy Father speaking. It is this, they're being reminded, you must do this, you must do that. Now, the difference is that now there are punitive sanctions which have been added to the refusal to do this or the rejection of doctrine. And in the accompanying document by Cardinal Ratzinger, he goes through this discussion of the various levels and weight of teaching and so forth, but makes the strong point, this doesn't mean you can accept some and reject others. You accept them all, and they have objectively and in themselves varying weights and so forth. But it doesn't have any subjective significance for the believing Catholic. So there we are.
And that sort of closes the loophole for these theologians in the canon law.
If you would figure that that settles it, that here you have not only the requirement, but you have punitive sanctions attached to the requirement, where do you go from here? Well, law has to be applied. Law has to be implemented. So we finally come back to another recent apostolic document, Apostolos Suos, in which the Holy Father draws attention to the authority of individual bishops. And he doesn't want this to be dissolved and scattered in very useful episcopal conferences. He doesn't want a bishop to be one vote at a meeting in Washington or someplace else. The bishop is the master of the faith in his own diocese. He will answer to God for what he does in that diocese. And it doesn't matter whether he was with the majority and the minority at some bishop's conference meeting and so forth. That's a document which I think brings together the authority of the bishop and the canonical requirement as to what theologians are expected to do. Now, the fact that theologians would consider this to be a kind of external constraint suggests that we have a problem here much deeper than just the implementation of a rule.
In 50 years, how do you think the Second Vatican Council will be regarded?
I think it is the most significant event in church history in our time. As we look back to the First Vatican Council, which is now, 150 years ago, well, not quite, but a long time ago, more than a century ago, what do we say about it? Well, there's certain things we notice. The definition of infallibility, of course, looms very large, and the document on faith looms large. But it was an unfinished council in many ways. So when we look back at its significance, we see it as something that didn't complete itself. And many people thought that Vatican II, even by name, was called a complete Vatican I. That would be a diminished sense, I think, of the importance of Vatican II. But I think when you look at those 16 documents, which of course are different kinds of dogmatic documents, pastoral documents, declarations, and so forth, that they are a blueprint for how the church can go into the next millennium. And if we follow that, if we implement that, then I think there will come a point when we can look back and say, that was the way to go. That was the way to go. And if we don't, I think they will give us a measure of our failure. I won't be there, but those people will have to say it's a measure of our failure.
And in our last minute, who is the best interpreter of what those documents mean and how they should be executed?
The best interpreter of Vatican II is without any doubt John Paul II. I mean, he's been at it ever since he was elected Pope in 1978 in his Angelus conferences, in his encyclicals, in all of his documents, and what he has promoted. That is how he sees himself. That is his essential job. He was there in the council as one of the bishops, the junior bishops there, but he was there. He was in on some of the commissions, and so he knew what the whole point of the thing was. And he particularly was sensitive to the sexual morality because he saw the significance of that in the kind of sensate culture in which we find ourselves nowadays. So I think one could not find a better guide than the magisterium itself as to what Vatican II is all about. When the Pope introduced the Catechism of the Catholic Church, he called his preface the Depositum Fidei, the deposit of faith, the phrase of St. Paul. And the Church sees itself as one generation among many, at any given point, it's one generation among many, and we are to pass on to the next generation what we have received, whole and entire.
And it is the responsibility of each of us to understand just what the Second Vatican Council taught and find ways of integrating it into our own lives. On behalf of Ralph McInerney, I'm Raymond Arroyo. See you next time.